So Collins and Clasby was an establishment firm, and they, the natives weren't going to give their business to just another partner in the firm. Is that, they were going to go outside of the firm when Stevens wasn't there anymore.
I can't say that. I have the impression now, I can check with Mary Alice, but I have the impression that after Ted left, Mary Alice represented them for a while. Now, why they changed over to me, I've got no idea. It may have been that they felt that Collins and Crosby was too much establishment.
Back into the latter 60s.
Incidentally, Ted filed the first protest to state selection of native lands.
That was for Minto. Minto lands, yeah. In the, as a native cause kind of the steamroll, did the lawyers from all the native groups get together at all?
Mm-hmm.
When was the meeting?
Probably the first AFN meeting. I'm not sure. It was an AFN meeting that I have a vague recollection of in Anchorage on, I think, Fireweed Boulevard, someplace. The next one I remember was at the next one I clearly remember was after Hickel was elected, when Burr appeared here in this room before AFN.
Was Burr a Boyko?
Burr.
Did Boyko ever appear before AFN?
Oh yeah, after he was appointed, I'm sure he did. I don't have a recollection of that, so I can't be sure.
Yeah.
Let's see, Boyko must have come in around mid-68, and AFN conventions tend to be held, you know, like October, November.
So your first meeting was about 67 with all of them?
With what?
In 67 with all of them, about that time?
I think so.
With all the lawyers? Was there ever a strategy?
Well, at the beginning, the claim strategy was, we've got to do something. What are we going to do? And there were some who advocated going to the Court of Claims for a money judgment. But the native leaders wanted land. They would have given up all of the money for the land. And the Alaskan attorneys, and except for Weisbrot, Lefty Weisbrot, there were no outside attorneys involved at the beginning. And during 67, the idea of land became more and more in the forefront. And during 67, we decided, no, we shouldn't go to court. What we should do is go to Congress. And then the question is, well, what do we ask Congress for? And that's where I came up with my ideas on regional corporations and land selection and village corporations. And we're going to have a statewide corporation, too. We lost that during the bargaining process with Congress, which incidentally is probably the most fantastic example of lobbying by a politically naive politically unpowerful group working their will on Congress and the administration in U.S. history.
Is there what the natives were keeping in
mind? Yes.
Did the lawyers for the natives follow what the natives wanted, or did the lawyers have a clear idea of what they thought the natives should be going for
my,
a chance at?
My comment was that we are technicians. We give you ideas. If you like the ideas, we'll run with them. If you don't like the ideas, we'll try something else. And McCutcheon was a very strong man, and so he tended to influence other people simply by the force of his personality. But the rest of us were not. And in truth, the Native leadership really controlled their lawyers, and they controlled, eventually, Congress and the administration.
McCutcheon, did McCutcheon persuade the natives of anything in particular?
Well, he persuaded Tyonek to give the Native movement $100,000 when the Native movement really needed it. But he didn't tell them how it was going to be done, and this is where it's going to be, because I tell you, as a great white father, no, he didn't do that. You ought to talk to Jack Hendrickson about that. He was much closer, and the Cliff Grove.
When did the first outside law firms start coming in?
Well, Belli got involved about 69, but he didn't have a big role to play. He didn't do a lot. But he'd had prior involvement in Alaska and knew Alaskan attorneys. The big breakthrough came when Fred Paul and or his father decided that what we needed was somebody who was a lawyer who had national reputation. And they decided that who we really needed was Arthur Goldberg. So through that, we got Arthur Goldberg involved. Lefty Weisbrot was already involved, and I think he approved the idea. There were other attorneys in his firm. Tolliver. I'm trying to think of another one, I can't. We got Arthur Goldberg up to Anchorage. I still remember the first meeting of Arthur Goldberg with the regional council. And I'll never forget that.
What happened?
Well, Arthur Goldberg was going like this while we were telling him the background of the claims movement and where we were. And he was frankly bored. He is without a doubt the most egotistical man I have ever met. Eventually, Jack Hendrickson told him off, which I was also privileged to see, because Jack at that time was probably around 26 years old. But despite that, we did tie up with Goldberg. And
what was his role to be? Just a spokesman?
To establish credibility with Congress and the administration.
Do you think it was necessary?
Yes. Yes. We also got Ramsey Clark, and Ramsey is much better. And between the two of them, and they had some good associates that I enjoyed working with, they really did a hell of a lot. But the problem with outside counsel is they don't really understand Alaska. You know? And here I am back here trying to work with the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association on easements. Yes, this is going to be our land, but you're going to be able to cross it. Now, if you want to shoot on it, hunt on it, you're going to have to maybe pay a fee, but yes, you can get through it to get to the other side. I'm talking with the city council. I've been city attorney for 3.5 years, so I'm talking to city attorneys in Juneau and Anchorage, and well, Juneau especially. Okay, you want to expand, and we've got a federal land out here, and you need to expand. Maybe it's a good thing that natives can select some land nearby, because you will be able to have land in private ownership, and you'll be able to develop. And I'm talking with the Chamber of Commerce about, hey, we've got 40 million acres of land in private ownership and $1 billion. Think what that's going to do to Alaska and business opportunities.
You did a lot of lobbying.
Did a lot of lobbying, not just with the legislature or Congress, but also with all the groups in Alaska. And that result was we never had any organized opposition until the last minute. And by that time, it was too late.
Who were the people who were opposed?
A lot of miners.
In terms of lawyers.
Among lawyers? You know, I can't think of a single lawyer during the course of the hearings before Congress that ever came out. I'm sure there are some. But no, they didn't. They were sitting on the sidelines. We had co-opted them. Not co-opted the lawyers, we had co-opted the special interest, saying, hey, yes, you've got concerns, how can we meet your concerns? And yes, we will be reasonable. And the net result was we didn't get organized opposition. There was a lot of opposition there. But it couldn't get organized, because anytime it started to get organized, we'd go talk to the leadership of these various organizations. And I spent time with the Alaska Miners Association. Joe Vogler, a miner, Alaska for Independence. He was one of the strong backers of the Native Claims Movement. He could see the advantages from the standpoint of miners and for Alaska. So,
who were the groups that could have been against it if you hadn't talked to the miners you mentioned? What were the groups that would have been against it? What other groups?
You name the group, they could have been against it. You know?
Or the were against it, the ones that you had that really convinced.
The biggest one we had, that I felt that I had, was with the miners and the chamber. But in Fairbanks, we got both of them. The miners basically didn't take a position in Fairbanks. State group did, and the chamber didn't, and we had the conservationists in Fairbanks in our corner, and we ran into a big problem with Sierra Club. Sierra Club wanted Alaska as a national park. We got the Conservation Society, Alaska Conservation Society, to go against the Saylor-Udall Amendment. And the Saylor-Udall Amendment was designed to make sure that neither the state nor the natives ended up with any land that had any economic potential. Someday you're going to have to take an oral history of the Native Land Claims Movement. I think you would enjoy that.
Where did your work end? Tell me the course of the work for the Native Settlement Act and when your work for Natives came to an end.
Okay, well,
every time I go to Senate,
starting 65, my initial work was paid for by the Association of American Indian Affairs. Eventually, they ran into, we could see they were going to run out of money. And
I'm a people who get shorter and shorter and shorter. First thing, not to look like.
I got contracts with a number of Native villages. Three of them were approved by the Secretary of Interior. I'm not going to get into that problem. 69, 68 was a heavy year, very heavy year. 69 was light because the Senate Interior Committee under Henry Jackson was doing a study to see what ought to be done. They came up with money and no land. Well, like a million acres of land, 3 million maybe. 70 was a heavy year, and 71 was a heavy year, and we passed the bill at the close of the congressional session in December. I went back. I moved out of the house. Marriage was over. In late 71. Passed the bill. Had the meeting at Alaska Methodist. When Nixon, by telephone to the assembled group of Native leaders from all over the state, announced that he would sign the bill if they said yes, and everybody said yes except Arctic Slope. We knew he was going to sign the bill, regardless of who. But then I incorporated Doyon Atna. And roughly by the end of that year, 72, or maybe sometime in 73, I was no longer representing Atna or Doyon, who had gotten into a border dispute, and I was in a conflict of interest situation, plus some other problems. What else happened? I had an ex-Marine who had bought some land and was in a land dispute with his Indian neighbor, who was from one of the leading people from Rampart, and it was creating real problems for me in the Native movement. I'm representing a white man against a Native. And my client wasn't the greatest, but he had a good case. And that created real problems for me. And asked Sam Keto. He fought the good fight for me for a number of years, for at least a year, trying to make sure that I would keep on representing Tenenbaum chiefs, and at the same time, he was having to fend off Native leaders from around Tenenbaum chiefs saying, how come Jackson is doing this, you know? And I didn't know what was going on. I did not know what was going on at the time until it was too late to do anything about it. And I thought about it since, and I would not have refused to represent John Ballas, but I might have handled it differently if I'd known what the problem was.
So they wanted exclusive representation, the Natives?
Well, like a lot of people, if you're not with us, you're against us. Now, my view is, if you're not against me, you're with me. Or at least I can talk to you. But most people are not that way.
What happened then with the Natives? What happened with them?
Well, I resigned Atna because I had a border dispute with Doyon.
And then Doyon.
And then Doyon decided they wanted somebody on full time, for reasons I've explained. And I wasn't willing to do that, and they knew I wasn't willing to do that. So they hired another attorney out of, I think, Hawaii.
Tony usually stayed with it.
Who tended to be intoxicated, which is not a bad thing, you know, but not when you're trying to work. And he couldn't work with me, and I was ready to defer to him. And I did defer to him. I said, hey, I'm just outside counsel, you tell me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that wasn't good enough. He lasted for a year or two. But by that time, I had resigned because I didn't have the right relationship. And if you're not in the right relationship, get out.
So since then, have you handled any native, any native cases?
For a couple of years, I was... For about 2 years, I was an attorney for Bering Straits. When Bering Straits got into trouble, I was not general counsel. They'd only come to me after the deal was made, and of course they always asked the other party to have their attorney write up the contracts because they wanted to save attorney's fees. And they lost probably $20 to $30 million because they were saving money on attorney's fees and consultants. I mean, it wasn't just attorney's fees. They were being very, very closed, you know, and trusting people instead of, and we had the means of checking people out, but they wouldn't do that. They wanted to be, we don't let anybody know what we're doing, and therefore we won't talk to Dun & Bradstreet, we won't talk to a banker in Anchorage, we won't talk to our lawyer, we'll make the deal. And it was a very expensive learning experience.
Did any Fairbanks attorneys ever get into representing natives?
During the land claims fight, none, except that there was a small group of natives southeast of here, like two or three people, that Ed Niewanner represented. The Salcha people. You ought to talk to Ed Niewanner about that, because Ed has been here for a long time. I didn't give you his name the other day.
But no other Fairbanks attorneys.
No.
After the outside law firms come up and start representing Diane and things like that.
I will. Art Lazarus, very good attorney. I have great respect for him. We got involved with Doyon before the bill passed. Probably one of the top lawyers in Indian law in the country.
Which firm is that?
You know,
Lazarus, same firm as Patricia Harris. Beyond that, I can't tell you the name.
Why did natives start going to outside counsel?
The same reason they came to me. They want to know that their attorney was loyal to them and had no possible conflicts of interest. And one of my major conflicts of interest was not my other clients, but the fact that I wanted to run for office. And they knew that I wanted to run for office. And therefore, how do you advise your client when you want to be maybe governor or something? Huh? That's a legitimate concern.
They wanted someone to deal exclusively for them, not for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have done anything different?
No, she couldn't hear anything from where I was.
Only in handling the John Ballas case, I probably would have gotten him another attorney who was capable and competent to handle the case, and I would have gotten out of it and been free to it. With Bering Straits, I would have probably resigned earlier. I didn't resign. As a matter of fact, I got fired by the executive vice president about a month or two before he got fired. Or I would have insisted, hey, what is my role? What are my responsibilities? Who do I answer to? And I was too easygoing, too willing to trust to the future that it will all work out.
But the Bering Straits, the reason that they fired you, or was it because they weren't using you and they thought their deals were... What brought that about?
That was one man's decision.
Why?
And I don't know to this day what the executive vice president's reasons were. My own view is he was getting into a difficult situation and I was independent. And I might give independent advice to the board, which I tried to do.
Oh, and you weren't going to give him it.
Yeah.
When was your last dealing with Native? When you moved out of the Native stuff, what did you do?
Well, it's strange because what happened was I was representing Bering Straits. I'd always done a little bit of bankruptcy. And Kowarik, which was the nonprofit for Nome, got into very serious financial difficulties, like $300,000 in debt and no money to pay anybody. And I suggested that you go into a Chapter 11 proceeding under the old bankruptcy law. We ended up paying about 40 cents on the dollar to unsecured creditors, including lien. The feds did not come across. The state did. The state recognized their obligations and paid us what they owed us, but we could never get any money from the feds. And during and after that Chapter 11 proceeding, I became known as somebody who knew what the hell he was talking about when it came to bankruptcy, and there are very few lawyers who know what they're doing in bankruptcy. So all of a sudden I started getting bankruptcy cases being referred to me from lawyers in Fairbanks and even in Anchorage. And now I have a bankruptcy practice.
Do you enjoy the bankruptcy practice?
It's like being an emergency room surgeon. They come into you, they're bleeding, they're dying, they don't see how they're going to survive, and within 2 to 4 weeks, maybe 6 weeks, they're into convalescence, and they're so happy. Yes. And I enjoy it. There are bad times. You've got some clients who dig their own graves, and when you dig them out of the grave, they blame you because you didn't get them out. Basically, yes. I'd recommend it. There are problems with it, but...
What are the problems?
Well, first of all, somebody who's bankrupt who comes to you can't meet their bills, how are they going to pay you to begin with? Secondly, in a business bankruptcy, you can only submit your bill for approval by the court every 4 months, and it takes then another 2 months anyway to get it approved, and then you get paid if the client then has money. And I've got one bankruptcy client, for example, who, not an example, the example, who, if he gets it, if he recovers, he owes me $80,000.
Well,
that's a good bit of work to do for somebody, you know, without any real assurance of getting paid.
Do you supplement with anything that's your share of getting paid with?
Yeah. Yeah. Not enough. I should do more. I'm too easy with my clients. My daughter gives me...
Do other people have bankruptcy practices? Are there other people who deal...
In Fairbanks, I'm probably the... I probably do more debtor work than anybody else, by far. Probably do half of it. Now, there's some attorneys who do creditor work. We represent creditors in bankruptcy cases, but then their client pays them, which is nice.
Do you ever think of playing both sides? Could you play both sides of that?
No, it's not practical, because there are only a certain number of major businesses in town that will have an attorney to represent them in bankruptcy cases. The chances are any debtor who comes into your office owes one of them some money. Now, in Anchorage or Seattle or San Francisco, it would be different.
But do other lawyers in town specialize? Like, you've been specialized. You've specialized almost from the start. Native law to bankruptcy. Some sort of specialization. Have there been other lawyers who specialize? You have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Will Chandel is a specialist in employment cases, employment discrimination, violation of employment contracts, etc. We have two or three attorneys in town who do a lot of workman's comp cases. Got one attorney in town who specializes in income tax. We've got a number of attorneys in town who are specialists in PI cases.
But are they all as precarious as a bankruptcy or some less precarious?
I'm not a gossiper, so I can't answer that. What I'm saying is that I don't sit down with attorneys and say, how are you doing with your practice? What are your problems, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just don't know.
Something like a PI, people who specialize in personal injury, what kind of contingent fees would you? Are they? I'm asking for comparisons rather than any kind of.
We've had some attorneys in town who've done very well in PI. Okay. There are others who have not done very well. We've got attorneys in town that do very well in criminal defense work. We've got others who are not. They do a lot of it, but they are not doing well. This is a fairly small community, and therefore it's very difficult to specialize. I picked up half the work in my field for the type of client I'm working for. Why did I put in an office in Anchorage? Because I want to be able to do work that I enjoy doing, and I enjoy going down there. I hate having to travel down there. I really don't like overnighting down there, but probably 15-20% of my income is now derived out of Anchorage.
Do you handle Anchorage cases, or do you have do you associate a saw on your door?
Oh, Jack Hendrickson was Anchorage attorney who worked with Cliff Groh and Ben Kurt and McCutcheon in the early days in the Land Grant Group. He and I are very good friends, and he provides me with office space in Anchorage, and I provide him with office space in Fairbanks. He's basically PI and basically bankruptcy. Now, how can they feed each other? I don't know, but it happens. In the early years, I probably gave him more cases than I got from him. Recently, I've gotten more cases from him, and vice versa.
Okay. So you've never had any partners or anything?
Oh, yeah.
You have.
Murray Nordale was partner. And before Murray Nordale. And I told you to talk to Murray Nordale. Tom Fenton was partner during the Len Hanks movement. That goes back to like 69, 70.
When was Murray Nordale partner?
1972, June, for about a year, year and a half.
Why did you bring in partners, or why did you have partners?
I had business. I couldn't take care of it. I was looking for a partner who would bring in business on their own, so I was not going to be, you know, just... Yeah. And they both... did attract their own business. That wasn't the problem.
But what's the problem?
Well, with Tom, we spent a hell of a lot of money on land clearance. And eventually he said, I can't afford it any longer. I'm going to get out. You can ask him about it, but that's... And Murray Nordale is... She's more independent than I am. She wanted things done her way. At the same time, she knew I had survived, I was functioning, and she didn't want to impress upon me her view of how things ought to be done. And she wanted to be her own boss. She didn't want to be a junior partner. She was capable of being, of having her own practice. And I enjoy her. I think she enjoyed practicing with me. But basically, she's a sole practitioner, just like I am.
Looking back over your career, has it gotten easier or harder as time's gone on?
All I can say is I'm feeling fine, and I've had tough times, but things seem to be getting better in terms of enjoying life, functioning, and being satisfied with myself and what I'm doing for people.
Had known that the $5,000 were going to be no good, he would just as soon have had Nellie get the $10,000. The court won't make that assumption. The court's making the assumption, listen, for some reason or another, he does not want to give Nellie $10,000. He wants to give her a lesser sum. He can't give her the lesser sum because the lesser sum is not validated according to the formalities of the statute of wills. The larger sum is revoked. The lesser sum is no good. And Nellie gets nothing. That's how revocation by interlineation, as coupled with dependent method of revocation, works. It's a deep, heavy morass of a subject, but you can read the outline. You can annotate that little picture diagram there, and you've got all the law you need to know about that problem, except the problem of probate code 350, which drives me nuts every time I think about it, all right? Because it really adds a totally unnecessary complication. But if we didn't have complicated problems, we wouldn't need 60,000 lawyers in the state of California now, would we? So maybe we ought to be happy that there are these complications in the law. Okay. Caveat probate code section 350 anytime you're dealing with revocation by interlineation. All right? What are we dealing with? We're dealing with class drill 12. All right, class drill 12. Look at what happens. What happens is that you've got the death of our particular character here. We've got the death at this point in time. All right? Now, what happens is that we discover when we get ready to probate his will that his will is lost or destroyed. Okay? Now, if it were destroyed, as we're going to have the problem in dependent relative revocation. If it was destroyed before he died at point X, if you're dealing with a situation of a lost or destroyed will before death, you got a big problem. Because probate code 350 will not allow you to prove up a copy of that will, even though you got 20 bishops to testify to the validity of that copy, that copy is verbatim what the destroyed will is. You cannot prove up that copy unless what? Unless you can show that the will was destroyed by fraud or by a public calamity. All right. Now that is to be definitely distinguished from the situation where you discover, hey, look, the will has been destroyed. I'm sorry, it's been lost. It's been burned up. But it was lost at point Y, after the testator died. Under probate code 350, when the will is destroyed after the testator dies, as long as you have two credible witnesses to testify that the copy you're presenting is a valid copy, you can put that copy into the evidence. Now, we can illustrate it by a little hypo that was beginning to get passe until Norman Lear started subscription TV and put the Towering Inferno back on. All right? Let's take a look at a little situation here. That little funny little diagram bears what? That's a high-rise office building, all right? And there's a fire that starts down below, all right? Now, what happens is the testator's lawyer is at floor 100. That's where the will is. The testator is on floor 90, let's say, all right? The fire burns up. Now, what happens to the testator? He becomes an enchilada. He's dead, all right? The fire goes up to the will on floor 100 and is destroyed. We got any problem in the probate code 350? Why? Because the will is destroyed after the testator died. We got two witnesses that can come in with a copy to prove that this is the copy. It's admitted. All right? Well, what happens if we work the other way? What happens if the testator is not on floor 90, the testator is on floor 110? Okay? And now what happens? The fire comes up, it destroys the will on floor 100 before it turns the testator into our proverbial enchilada. So the will is destroyed before death. Can we prove up a copy? Sure, why? What's the fire? The fire is a public calamity. If the will is destroyed before death in a public calamity, probate code 350 still allows us to prove it up. All right. Now, what if the fire has started? And the testator says, son of a bitch, I got to change my will. And he writes out a new will. He doesn't know about holographic wills, so he doesn't sign it. He's willing to get two witnesses. It's sitting there on his desk. All right? What happens? He runs down to floor 100, rips up will number one, destroys it by physical act, gets in the elevator to go up to floor 110, the elevators are gone, he's fried, there's no execution of the second will. Okay, what can we do now? Why did he revoke the first will? He revoked the first will because he thought he was going to make it back up there to execute that second will. He didn't. If he had known that he was not going to make it up there to execute that second will, he never would have destroyed the first will. In most jurisdictions, that's a classic case to apply the concept of dependent relative revocation. In California, it's a classic case to apply the concept of dependent relative revocation. Why? Why was Will 1 revoked? Because he thought Will 2 was going to be valid. Will 2 wasn't valid. As long as the provisions are generally consistent, you can disregard the revocation of the first will. Super. We disregard the revocation of Will 1. Now we are faced with what problem in California? How do we admit a copy? Unless we can convince the court that because Will number 1 was destroyed before his death, as the result of a public calamity, we don't get the copy in. We don't get the copy in. Probate Code 350 is a major block to proving up cases under dependent relative revocation. Now, I got to tell you this. Of recent times, the bar examiners, when they put this thing together originally, I think, didn't really understand what they'd done by adding Probate Code 350, because they'd had all these detailed dependent relative revocation problems, and the goddamn will would be destroyed, and the analysis would be hideous, and even though dependent relative revocation works perfectly, Probate Code 350 doesn't allow you to prove up the copy. So what have they done of recent? Of recent times, they have gone to the basic situation of having a valid will, having that valid will revoked, having that valid will revoked by physical act. How do they get around Probate Code 350? The physical act is induced by what? You guessed it, fraud. Okay? When you can prove dependent relative revocation, when you can prove that that revocation was induced by fraud, what happens? DR, dependent relative revocation, lets you have that first will back in effect. How do you prove it up? Probate Code 350, as long as you've got a good copy and two credible witnesses, allows you to prove up that will even though it was destroyed before death because it was destroyed by fraud. And that's the way validity and revocation work. It is a son of a bitch, huh? I mean, there are a lot of rules there. Wills is a rule-oriented course. And when I was first given the assignment to do this, I said to myself, my God, it's impossible. It's impossible. But you take a look at it, and you study the past questions, and you watch the way they fit together, and there is a flow. Now, it is April 19th, 1980. You had a long time between now and the last week in July. Now what happens is that for those people who don't see this tape until the last week of the course, it usually gives them a big laugh because they got about 10 days to soak this stuff up. I tell you people on the tape, even though you only got 10 days, if you'll take the approach and wrestle with it for several hours and work through the hypotheticals, it works. And before I let you go for lunch, I'm going to show you how it works in one of the easier questions. Let's take a look at hypothetical number one. It's on the back side of revocation. I wanted to finish up because the name of this game is confidence, all right? You've got to have confidence. Now let's take a look at this question. It was given in 1979, all right? It's one of the easier questions. That's why I give it to you just before the lunch break, all right? Well, we finish today, I'll give you the tougher ones. Tessie, a widow, died leaving a two-page handwritten will having two dispository clauses. Clause 1 provided for a bequest of $10,000 to each of my children, Anne, Brad, and Charlie. Clause 2 provided that all of Tessie's stocks and bonds be given to Brad to be used as we have agreed. Tessie's home and her personal effects, together with $60,000, were not disposed of by the will. Tessie had signed her name on the bottom of page 1 of the will. Page 2 contained only the date in her handwriting and Brad's signature as a witness. When the will was offered for probate, several lines had been drawn through Anne's name in clause 1, but the will is otherwise not altered. Brad is prepared to testify that several months after signing the will, Tessie, in his presence, drew lines through Anne's name, and Tessie told him she wanted to disinherit Anne. Well, there's our old friend, disinheritance by fiat. Brad is also prepared to testify that he had agreed with Tessie to use the income from the stocks and bonds for Charlie, but that the stocks and bonds were to be Brad's after Charlie's death. Charlie died several months before Tessie, leaving no spouse or descendants. The estate includes, in addition to Tessie's home and personal effects, $10,000 cash in stocks and bonds worth $70,000. Assume the applicable statutory provisions are the same as the comparable provisions of the California Probate Code. Don't do away with it's a will's question. That's the only way that they can tell you that it's a will's question. The only other way is you've got to be careful, and we'll work on this in crossover technique, in community property. We can get a will's issue. Why? Because community property says answer according to California law. What's California law include? The California Probate Code. All right? Two, if the will is valid, how should the estate be distributed? Discuss. Now, this is one of the few instances. Most of my approaches and my mind techniques are flexible. They have their ability to be changed by you. The approach in wills can be changed. I mean, you can add, you can subtract, you can redraw the diagrams. If I get you to do that, boy, I have really accomplished my mission, which is to show you how to learn. You get involved with the subject. Now, the method, however, for answering a wills question, I want to tell you, I've been doing this for 15 years. You look at every single question that comes down. There is no way, as I'm going to say from time to time, throughout this course, there is no way to keep these facts straight in your head unless you happen to be the clone of Justice Cardozo. There is no way to keep these facts straight without a diagram. And in wills, what you do is on the right-hand side of the page, you lay out your family tree. You put the testator in his pine box. Testator is Tessa. Tessie. She had a husband. He's croaked. You can draw an X through H. They had kids. A, B, and C. You take a look at the facts. You draw a cross through C. C's not around. C's dead. Right. On the right-hand side, you draw the family tree. Why? Because for the last 5 years, everybody California wills question has involved problems of intestacy. And the only way you're going to be able to visualize who takes the intestate share is to have the family tree. Okay? Now, what do? On the left-hand side, you then chart out the instruments and events. This is an easy question. Why? There's only one will. There's only one document, the holographic will, $10,000 to each of A, B, and C, stocks and bonds to B, home and personal effects not disposed of. Okay, what do? You test the problem for validity, revocation, and what we're going to do this afternoon, distribution, and then you look for intestacy. Okay, what about validity? Capacity, you got any problems with capacity? This lady seemed to be of the right age. She had kids, she's got to be over 18. There was no problem with mental delusion, no problem with mental deficiency. How about intent? We got no problem. Capacity, intent, they're all okay. This is how you run it through your mind. This is the mental checklist. If you want, you can write it out on your scratch paper. But you'll start out your answer. The holographic document seems to be okay as far as capacity and intent are concerned. However, the major problem here is whether or not the formalities of the statute of wills have been met. This does not qualify as an attested will because the number of witnesses is not enough. There's only one witness in Probate Code 50. You don't have to know the Probate Code section. All you have to know is you need two witnesses. There are not two witnesses, okay? Now, however, what about Probate Code 53, the holographic will? Hey, this instrument is dated, it's signed, it's all in the testator's handwriting. Oops! What's on the second page? The witness's signature. What's the problem? The problem is the document is not all in the testator's handwriting. There is something else there. Now what do you have to wrestle with? You have to wrestle with the law fork. Is this jurisdiction going to use the surplusage test? If it does, the witness's signature is pure surplusage and the document will stand. Or is it going to use the intent to incorporate test? If it uses the intent to incorporate, Testy clearly asked this guy to sign, therefore she clearly intended to incorporate his signature, even though it's mere surplusage, the document fails. That's the concept of forking. You take the basic issue both ways in terms of validity of the will. And what do you do in terms of distribution of the estate? You've got two problems. Either A, the will is valid, or it is invalid. If the will is valid, what happens? How about Anne? Her testate gift was revoked. But hey, look. What's the problem? She's not otherwise taken care of. You go through your whole world of revocation. What happens? You got a kid in there. There's no provision there for Ann anymore. Therefore, she can step up and take her intestate share, unless you want to construe, unless what? Unless you want to construe the lining out as an indication that Ann was to take nothing. Even if you do, however, what happens? Brad's gift is okay. He gets his $10,000, but there's no residuary clause. What happens to the balance of the property? It goes intestate. And how much does Ann get? Now, I want to show you something here. When I get up and I do these presentations, sometimes people say that he is an egomaniac. All right? Now, let me tell you, there's a difference between having a large ego, which lawyers need, and being sick. All right? The difference is that a large egomaniac who is psychotic doesn't admit errors. I'm going to show you. This was a true error on my part because I didn't follow my own drill when I made out this outline. If I wanted to, I could tell you that the intestate share is a typo when it says one-third. You want to know the real truth? The real truth is that when I put this damn diagram together, I forgot to follow my own drill to X out C. And when you X out C, what happens? Then you clearly see that there are only two intestate heirs, A and B. And they split the intestate share 50-50. But wait a minute, what about that evidence that Ann was to take nothing? What is that? That's an attempt to disinherit by fiat. The only way you can cut somebody out of their intestate share is to provide a valid alternative scheme. And that hasn't been done here. The only thing that's valid under this will, if anything, is the gift to Brad. And everything else passes intestate. Who are the intestate heirs? Ann and Brad. No disinheritance by fiat. Brad, what are the problems there? He takes his testate gift, a little teaser for tomorrow, if you can stand this high pressure, if not, wait for the tape. The gift to Brad is what we call a semi-secret trust. What happens is Brad wants to come in and prove up these details. Will he be allowed to? Quick preview, courts are split. Some courts say yeah, some courts say no. We'll talk about that in the first hour of tomorrow morning. All right? How about the intestate share? Again, he takes a half. He takes a half because he's one of the two intestate shares. What about Charlie? Charlie's dead. Therefore, Charlie, as we're going to see this afternoon, his gift is lapsed. Now, if Charlie, again, a little preview for this afternoon, if Charlie had left lineal heirs, then his lineals would step up under probate code 93 and take his interest. They would take his interest. They'd take another probate code 93. They'd also take it under the laws of intestate succession, come to think of it, because they would be the intestate heirs. But he didn't leave anybody, and as a consequence, he takes nothing. What happens if the will is not valid? If the will is not valid, then what happens is it just the whole thing passes intestate. A half to Ann, a half to Brad. Okay. What do we want to do now? It is 10 minutes to 1 by my watch. Let's try and take a short lunch and take up again at 20 minutes to 2, huh? Let's take up again at 20 minutes to 2 at 1:30, and we ought to be out of here by around 3 o'clock is what I'd guess, okay?